Case number SCWC-15-0000329, State of Hawaii v. Yoko Kato. Arguing for the petitioner, Myron H. Takemoto. Arguing for the respondent, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen K. Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Mr. Takemoto and Mr. Tsushima. Excuse me, I built ready to proceed this morning.
Yes.
All right, so Mr. Takemoto, you deserve 5 minutes for the public warning, 5 minutes to go, Mr. Tsushima will be open. So please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices Myron Takemoto on behalf of Yoko Kato, the appellant petitioner, defendant in this case. Ms. Kato was charged with attempted murder in the second degree. This proceeded to a jury trial back in 2014. The jury came back with a verdict of guilty of the included offense of reckless endangering in the second degree. The defense theory in this case was that either this third party, David Miller, was either responsible for the stabbing, or he set up the stabbing, or was involved in the stabbing. Also, that he had set my client up. The state's theory of the case from beginning to end was that Yoko Kato was the sole participant, that she was basically they relied on principal liability, that she was the only person involved, there was no one else involved from the beginning to end. We've raised four issues in our appeal, whether or not reckless endangering second degree was properly instructed to the jury, whether there was substantial evidence to support the conviction for reckless endangering second degree. Thirdly, whether or not the court abuses discretion in failing to compel David Miller, a non-party witness, to testify over his Fifth Amendment privilege. And finally, that the court, whether the court made an error in adducing evidence that David Miller, whether or not David Miller had a motive to commit the crime charge. My arguments relating to the first two points regarding the reckless endangering second degree jury instructions as well as substantial evidence, whether or not there's substantial evidence are somewhat related, so I'll kind of mesh those together. Our position is that the reckless endangering in the second degree jury instruction was erroneously given in this particular case. We do acknowledge right off the bat that reckless endangering can be a included offense or a lesser included offense of attempted murder under the case law, Feliciano and Rombawa. However, our position is that the jury instructions as a whole were prejudicially insufficient, erroneous, inconsistent, or misleading. The basis for our argument is that the state's theory in this case was principal liability, and the court never instructed on accomplice liability.
Couldn't she commit reckless endangering to as a principal, even if there was someone else involved? I mean, she could, her own actions, even if she was not the stabber, could provide a basis for both the instruction and the evidentiary foundation for reckless endangering. Isn't that correct?
I don't believe so, because if Ms. Kato lured or planned and lured the complaining witness to the location and recklessly placed the complaining witness in danger of death or seriously bodily injury,
and someone else stabbed her.
And someone else stabbed her. The only way that would have been able to have taken place is that she knew that the stabber was there waiting. In other words, that there was an accomplice.
Wouldn't that be an inference from the evidence in these circumstances? Why would the jury have to be explicitly instructed on accomplice liability given the nature of the reckless endangerment charge, just placing someone
Well, I think under the circumstances of this case, that accomplice liability was, that instruction was necessary for there to be a conviction, for the reckless endangerment to even have been given. And this is evidenced in the communications from the jury. The first communication from the jury was, can we consider whether someone else aided Kato? In other words, referencing to accomplice. The second degree.
So that's whether somebody else aided Kato and Kato was the principal and somebody else was the accomplice. Isn't that what the question is?
No.
Somebody else aided Kato?
Aided Kato. And in reference to the sick, and to answer your question on Justice Nakayama, I'll refer you to the second jury communication wherein, and this is on December 19th at 12:12 p.m. After deliberating yesterday afternoon plus all morning, we are still hung 50-50. Skipping one line. Some of us feel that Yoko Kato is not guilty because there's reasonable doubt whether Yoko actually held a knife and stabbed Rio. Others feel there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Yoko took actions to lead Rio to Kaunaoa Street where someone was waiting to stab Rio. The question, does the charge include Yoko intentionally conspiring to have Rio stabbed without actually being the stabber? So the jury communications indicate that what they wanted to know was whether or not the charge being attempted murder, had an accomplice liability was relevant or not.
Whether she was an accomplice to that. She was never convicted of it, though.
But I guess the reason she may not have been convicted of accomplice is because no instruction was given. And the government, in its answering brief, this is what they say. Here there was substantial evidence that the defendant participated in planning the attack on Takako and lured her to the location of the attack. So under that theory, and it seems like the ICA also agreed with that theory, that they were working together, how would the jury know what accomplice liability would require? I mean, how would the jury know that there has to be intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the crime? And yet we have arguments here that the government has given that saying, well, she participated. She was an accomplice, essentially.
Well, the jurors don't know what the law is, and they rely upon the court, and that's why my argument is that the jury instructions as a whole were prejudiced in insufficient, misleading,
and
erroneous.
And it seems we've held that defective accomplice instructions will require a vacating. Here, it seems like it's even more significant in that we don't even have an instruction that could have been defective. There's no instruction at all.
I agree. There was no instruction, and the only way under our theory that she could have been convicted of reckless endangering second is if there was an instruction. That's the only one.
Why can't she be guilty as a principal for her actions in placing someone in danger, cheerfully acknowledging that she wasn't the stabber?
Well, the IC.
Why can't she be convicted of that?
Well, the ICA did in upholding the convictions didn't indicate that there's substantial evidence that Ms. Kato, acting or pretending to be this I Akinishi, used line application to lure Takako or someone who may or may not have been Kato herself was waiting there to stab her. Again, we would submit that
under all the circumstances of the case, isn't there enough evidence to suggest that she did a number of things which in context could be viewed as having recklessly put the complaining witness in danger, whether she did it even if she wasn't the person who stabbed her?
There was. I would agree. I mean, this is a strange circumstances as far as this particular case, to say the least. It was complicated. This case took a while to try, but the bottom line is our belief is, or our argument is, that without the accomplice liability instructions, there's no way you can get to the reckless endangering conviction. I mean, that's a position.
You misunderstood, and so did Justice Paul. I didn't say, gee, she got acquitted of accomplice liability attempted murder. She got acquitted of attempted murder. She got convicted of reckless endangering. If she, I don't understand your theory on how she can't be convicted of reckless endangering without an accomplice liability instruction. How does accomplice liability, how is that an element of reckless endangering?
It's not an element, Justice Nakayama.
Then why would they need to be instructed in order to convict her of that?
Our argument, the defense argument, is that the reckless endangering statute requires a person engages in conduct which that recklessly places another person in danger of death or serious bodily injury.
Is there evidence to support that in the record?
There's
one of your arguments is there isn't substantial evidence to
there
support
there isn't substantial
it.
Evidence. Okay.
But one of the elements of substantial evidence is not accomplice liability, is it?
No, no. That's not what my argument is. I'm just saying that because the state proceeded on a theory of principal liability.
And it
she was the stabber from the beginning, and at closing she was a stabber at the end. There's no one else involved.
And they were unsuccessful in that theory. But just because that is the prosecution's theory, it's not binding on the finder of fact, is it? The finder of fact makes an independent determination of what the actual, if there was an offense committed, what the actual offense was.
It is. I agree, Justice Nakayama. However, the jury communications seem to indicate that they were basically asking if somebody else was involved.
Could I ask you about that issue, Mr. Takamoto? I'm sorry, Justice Pollack.
Does the government, I thought I read that the government acknowledged they didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person was a stabber. They say that. So if she wasn't the person who stabbed, then somebody else was, and she had to be an accomplice of that person in order to get a conviction here.
That's correct. That's correct. Just and I'll also indicate, ask the justices to look back at the record in this case where we're in. The response to the jury was, to that second communication was, no. The court did not clarify that you couldn't find her guilty for essentially accomplice liability for attempted murder, but also did not clarify and indicate that you couldn't find her guilty for any of the included offenses as well, such as assault.
Did you object to the giving of the reckless endangering?
I did, and there was some confusion in as far as the opening briefs and whatnot, but we did object. I did look back at my records, and we did not submit any reckless endangering. The defense did object, and there's indications in the court's working copy of the jury instructions that there was an objection by the defense.
Mr. Takamoto, I'm interested in it when you refer to the question from the jury that implied maybe the jury was thinking somebody else was responsible. One of your arguments and allegations of error is that you weren't permitted to submit evidence of motive. And can you clarify what evidence you felt was excluded and how it pertained to the issue of motive, which I guess had to do with the motive that pertained to Mr. Miller?
That's the fourth issue that we raised on appeal, and that's relating to the Rabaliza issue. The government basically said because there's this motive and motive alone, you can't argue it. You can't submit that to the jury, and we would submit that there was, under the Rabaliza case, legitimate tendency that the third person, that being Mr. Miller, could have committed the crime.
What was the evidence? What was the evidence that you felt was improperly excluded?
Well, initially, or at the outset, he did have a motive to commit the crime against the complaining witness. Basically, they were together for about a month. They lived together. He said he loved her. He wanted to marry her. She left his residence shortly after that. She had no further contact with him after telling him that she loved him, she missed him, and she would come and see him soon. Essentially, she broke up with him without having told him that she was breaking up with him. She also, our argument is that the David Miller had a motive to frame Ms. Cotto because she was a complaining witness against him in an abuse case. She filed a TRO against him. He abused her on May 11th and 12th, 2013. Mr. Miller told my client that you ruined my life and he would get her back. And he forced her to write a letter essentially recanting the abuse allegations. As far as the specific evidence that we would argue under Ravalisa that there was more than motive is that the evidence in the case is one that there was a male, the witnesses, uncontroverted evidence that there was a male.
It was not uncontroverted.
Well, I take that back. There was evidence that two witnesses said that there was a male. The complaining witness, and this is something I should have brought up at the outset, and I do apologize because this is significant, is that the government in this particular case totally ignored the fact that the complaining witness, when she testified under oath before the jury, unequivocally stated that my client did not stab her, that she was not the stabber. She lived with my client for 2 days. They had a number of conversations. Knew how she spoke, knew how she moved, and unequivocally.
And that was testimony on cross-examination, and your argument is that is evidence of the nexus that would justify the admission of the motive evidence?
Well, yes, as far as that, as far as the suspect being a male.
Mr. Takamoto, though, Ravalisa requires a nexus in connection to the actual commission of the offense. It's not motive, it's not description. It has to be a connection to the commission of the offense. How does the complaining witnesses saying that it's Cotto, how is that an actual nexus of Miller's connection to the commission of the offense?
It's not. And I apologize if I misspoke and said it along those lines. So. As far as Ravalisa, that doesn't apply. What I was referring to was that the evidence in the case was it was a male, it was a Caucasian. David Miller,
let's go back to that.
Okay.
At some point in time when the initial officer reports, mm-hmm. and admittedly the complaining witnesses isn't a fluent English speaker.
Correct.
The initial reporting officer says that she said he was Caucasian. Well, one thing, there are a lot of Caucasians, so that can't be one of the connecting factors. But also, the complaining witness explains, I didn't say Caucasian. And consistently, afterwards, she never says that the attacker was Caucasian. Is that correct?
Well,
So at one point in time, one of the descriptions from the police officer says she said it was a Caucasian man. Is that going to be, even if that were true, and even though she refuted it every time else, and it doesn't seem like any other witnesses say that it's a Caucasian man. Just the fact that it's a Caucasian man, can that possibly be a nexus?
Well, it's not only the fact that it was a male and it was a Caucasian, but also the body type she described was medium build, the height, the descriptions in it were going anywhere from 5'4 to 5'8. Mr. Miller is 5'10".
Did the complaining witness ever testify as to whether or not the person who stabbed her was or could have been David Miller?
She was never asked that.
She wasn't asked that.
She was not asked that question.
By you either. You didn't ask that question either.
No, because our theory in these cases, even if it wasn't David Miller that stabbed her, he was somehow involved in setting her up and setting Ms. Cotto up in this particular case.
So he had a link to the commission of the offense.
He was seen with her
the night. What? Wasn't he the same with her at her apartment the same evening or something?
He was with Ms. Cotto in her apartment that evening. Correct.
The link isn't what it is. I mean, the link that you're talking about is motive. And motive is not the causal, the connection, the nexus to the commission of the offense. We're talking about a lot of people are Caucasian males. A lot of people maybe carry a knife, but doesn't there have to be a connection to the commit, not motive, like he was maybe mad at her because she ghosted him, but there has to be a connection to the actual commission of the offense.
And part of my argument, I'm going back to, is that I'm going back to the third basis for the appeal, is as far as developing the link, we were basically precluded. We were shut down from asking.
Asking Mr. Miller, right?
Asking Mr. Miller questions.
Questions because he pled the fifth.
Because he pled the fifth.
Right. But it's not that the trial judge said you can't elicit any evidence of his motive, right? The trial judge just did not compel him to testify.
No.
You could have asked her to take judicial notice of the fact that there was a restraining order. And or there was an abuse charge, right? You could have elicited evidence of his potential motive through other methods other than having him testify, right?
Correct. And that would have been through my client.
Not just through your client. I mean, why couldn't you ask the judge to take judicial notice of a restraining order and or an abuse charge? It had already been dismissed by this time.
It had been, the abuse charge was reclassified to a harassment.
Before the incident?
It was after the incident.
All right, but why couldn't you ask the judge to take judicial notice of that?
I did not think of that.
And then in terms of him being with Ms. Cato on the night of the incident, how were you able to ascertain that?
That was through statements made by David Miller to, it came out during the course of the testimony through another witness, Yui Mochizuki, who is Ms. Kato's former roommate.
Right, and she testified that therefore, you could have argued that, you know, despite, I'm not quite sure what the theory is, but despite the fact that he had a restraining order against him and or an abuse charge against him with respect to Ms. Cato, they were together that night. What I'm saying is the judge did not preclude you from arguing his motive. She just precluded you from eliciting that evidence through Mr. Miller.
Actually,
is that correct?
That's incorrect.
Okay, so she did.
The trial judge indicated that I was not allowed to argue motive before the jury. And essentially, I couldn't point the finger at David Miller.
Oh,
the only thing that I could have said was that there was reasonable doubt and it was someone other than my client.
There was lack of evidence?
According to the court.
Well, and you didn't put in other evidence of motive, did you?
I couldn't because she wouldn't allow me to elicit it.
McKenna said if you had put in other evidence, then there would have been evidence of motive, and then you could have argued it.
If I had done it, so theoretically.
But how is there the absence of any evidence that links Miller to commission? Commission includes any single aspect of the offense. I mean, we have a jury that sends back communications, which obviously believes, because it's the evidence is just not only percolating, but it's just manifest that he's involved. And how can there be a finding that there's an absence of any evidence? Absence, no evidence. This is a relevancy standard. Robaliza is, in fact, that's what Bowman on evidence says. This is relevancy. Our other case, this is, we cannot create an evidence rule beyond Rule 401. The evidence code governs the admission of evidence. Relevancy and 403. How could it be excluded?
And I agree that we should have been allowed to get into motive. I mean, at least argue to the jury.
The jury had heard that they knew about him, Mr. Miller, having been in a relationship with the CW, and then before that with Ms. Cato, and then on the night of the incident, he's again with Ms. Cato.
Yes. So.
Well, the court told you, I just don't see a nexus. That was what the court said, that for whatever reason, the court concluded that there wasn't a nexus and was precluding you from offering evidence, but now I think we're trying to get to the specifics about what nexus weren't you able to establish? I mean, did you want to put in more evidence that he was angry? Because that's what it seems to be from the nature of the discussion here, more evidence that he was angry at her because she was with another man. And
that all goes to the arguments of my third issue on appeal, and that is relating to the Kupihea issue.
Well, Mr. Takemoto, let's be clear. Robolesis doesn't preclude you from putting in evidence of a nexus. It precludes you from putting in evidence of motive. So, for instance, gee, there's another man in California who would have had a motive to attack Kato. But if he doesn't have any connection to the offense, motive is irrelevant if you can't connect it to the offense, or else a party could put in all sorts of motive that doesn't have necessarily anything to do with the actual offense. So we're talking about not nexus information, not nexus evidence, but motive evidence.
Well, motive, again, going to the third issue of reason appeal, is that the Fifth Amendment privilege that was asserted by Mr. Miller, essentially the court used the wrong standard and said the possibility of him being prosecuted. Well, our position is that there was no possibility. I mean, not only was there a remote possibility, there's no possibility he was going to be prosecuted for the abuse, the harassment, the May 11th, May 13th abuse, also the, or even in this instant case, because the government treated him as a witness. And this is one of the points I wanted to be made, again, I'm short on time, but what I wanted to make was the government treated Mr. Miller as a witness up until the day before opening statements. So the police treated him as a witness, never read him his rights, he was never arrested, he was never considered a suspect. The prosecutors called him at the preliminary hearing as a witness. In their notice of intent, they identified him as a material witness. And motions in limine, he's still a witness. They're willing to offer him immunity.
Are you suggesting they were precluded from prosecuting him in the future?
No. I mean, what,
if he offers testimony that links himself to what happened that night, I'm trying to understand why that wouldn't be a valid grounds for him asserting the privilege. If he implicates himself by testifying, well, I was there, I was dinner, I was the aide that you mentioned the call, whatever it was, that's all we intend to link him to the event.
Theoretically, he could have, but I know he wouldn't have, as a matter of fact.
But the government
gave two statements to the police.
But didn't Mr. Takemoto? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but didn't the government refuse to provide immunity?
Initially, they did, until the day before jury selection. The day before opening. The day before opening, they totally reversed course, and indicated that we're not going to call him as a witness. We're going to refuse to give him immunity.
Isn't that a signal?
Appoint him counsel.
Isn't that a signal to his counsel that since they're not giving him immunity, he might have some exposure?
Well, he had exposure both ways, right? I mean, as a potential, as to the incident that's charged here, as well as at that time with respect to the restraining order violation, as well as the abuse charge.
Well, the abuse charge was prosecuted as a harassment, and the statute of limitations had run by the time the.
But what about the restraining order violation?
The restraining order, theoretically, yes. But I do want to point out that on December the 9th, the prosecutor candidly stated on the record, the trial prosecutor indicated, but you know it's available relating to the 5th, even though I don't think anybody would prosecute him. And the amount of time that has passed, it was a year and a half.
But Mr. Takemoto, you yourself said he also threatened Kato to get her to recant. Isn't that a separate criminal offense for which he had not been charged?
He denied it. When I asked him, he denied it.
It still leaves him open. You could still have questioned him about it. You could have elicited information regarding it. So he still is vulnerable to a criminal prosecution.
So he was vulnerable, as Justice Nakayama said, to even being prosecuted for his conduct in this case, yet we make a conclusion that he doesn't have a motive. I'm not sure how those two things wash.
Did the jury see Mr. Miller?
He did, and this is one of the...
I'm sorry, I should have pinned this down, but is he Caucasian?
So the state didn't call him as a witness. The day before, they changed course and said, you can call him as a witness. So we had to call him as a witness. And the timing of this, the day before jury selection, the 104 hearing on what he could take the fifth on, what he could and couldn't take the fifth on, took place 5 days later after opening statements and after 11 witnesses.
So the jury saw him?
And then when we called him as a witness, he had a different attorney and asserted his fifth rights, his Fifth Amendment rights to even greater extent. So questions he answered at the first.
Please, did the jury see him?
Yes.
Did they know that it was Mr. Miller?
Yes.
But is he Caucasian?
Yes.
Time has expired, but okay. We'll give you some time in rebuttal.
Okay.
At this point, would you rather say
I'd save the time. Thank you, Chief Justice. Well. Thank you.
For the record, may it please the court, Deputy Prosecutor Attorney Steven Tsushima, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice, and Associate Justices, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
I think there's one thing petitioner and respondent can definitely agree on. This is one of the strangest cases we've seen. The circuit court itself said it in the middle of the trial, not in front of the jury. And it is. It's a strange case. It's an unusual case. The issues presented here are different, are unique. It was a circumstantial evidence case. And the state's case was based on eyewitness misidentification at night. And that's what makes it strange.
I'm sorry, did you say the state's case was
Based
on misidentification?
Misidentification, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Misidentification of eyewitnesses at night, because we'll concede the eyewitnesses referred to the stabber as a male, as a boy.
So the state's theory was that your complaining witness was incorrect or lying?
Incorrect.
Incorrect.
Misidentification okay. of defendant.
So you basically charged this as Ms. Kato as the principal, correct. As the person that committed the stabbing.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So how can, you could have charged this alternative. You could have presented an alternative theory that she was an accomplice to whoever she got to commit the stabbing, correct? Right?
Correct.
And you could have charged reckless endangering potentially or assault or attempted murder and as an accomplice and coming down to reckless endangering or even just reckless endangering separately for acts that she did not commit or someone else committed.
Correct.
But in this case, the reckless endangering was only given as a lesser included of the original charge of attempted murder for which you charged her as the person that committed it, right?
Right. I was going to say that if we had gone forward with an accomplice liability theory, then it would have applied to the assaults, the attempted murder, everything you just said, except for the reckless endangering, because it wouldn't have been proceeding as an accomplice to reckless endangering. Reckless endangering itself encompasses...
Right. You could have charged that separately
as an either.
But in this case, it was only charged as an included offense of the original attempted murder with her, where the instruction says
correct.
That you have to show that you have to show the defendant's intent to commit...
To engage in conduct with recklessness.
Commit murder in the second degree, which is intentionally knowingly causing the death of another person.
Okay, sorry. I thought you were
defendant's intent to commit.
Right.
Essentially, we're expecting the jury, I think what Justice McKenna may be getting at, and pardon if I'm not right, is that, the jury's, the whole theory of the case is that the defendant does the conduct. And your theory, you said, was that that she was incorrect, although the jury found she was correct and rejected that she was the person, which you've acknowledged in your brief, that she wasn't the stabber, okay?
Right.
So, therefore, we're supposed to assume that the jury knew when they got to reckless endangering that somehow they knew that they were dealing with not making her the stabber and using her as an as somehow participating in planning without knowing what the law requires to be an accomplice.
Well, because it wouldn't be an accomplice as to reckless endangering. All they needed to do was read what they're required to find, and that's engages in conduct which recklessly places another person in danger of death or serious bodily injury.
But they that's in a vacuum because nobody had ever argued that she could have committed the offense by planning or participating. It only comes out through the questions that's what they're looking at. In other words, the whole theory was that she was the actor the entire time. Then all of a sudden, during the deliberations, they don't believe she's the actor, but then they look at reckless endangering and say, maybe if she participates in it, it's okay. But under our law, just participating is not enough. They need the accomplice instruction to correctly apply it. If you're going to hold somebody responsible and not be the actor, then they need the accomplice instruction to make that determination.
Not to be found guilty of reckless endangering in the second degree. I understand what you're saying, Justice Pollack, but it wasn't in a vacuum. They were instructed exactly what they needed to find in order to find defendant guilty of reckless endangering in the second degree. It's not as an accomplice to it.
Mr. Tsushima, I was going to point that. It's not in a vacuum. They listen to the evidence. That's assuming if you're going to say it's in a vacuum, it's like the jury's on their own and they can't look at evidence on their own and come to their own conclusions. Even though the state's case was, well, the evidence was just really odd.
It wasn't here.
But it was up to the jury to not accept the state's case. And they could look at their evidence and they could decide what charge the evidence supported.
And we believe the verdict that they came back with fairly reflects that it did not accept the state's theory of the case.
Well, let me ask you, if you said in your answering brief there was substantial evidence that the defendant participated in planning the attack on Takaku and alerted to the location of the attack. If that's what they found, is she guilty or not of reckless endangering?
When I was citing that, it wasn't in, it was just citing some of the facts of the case, not what they must have found in order to find reckless endangering in the second degree. When I wrote participated in planning, what's clearly missing is not with another person. I wasn't referring to it as an accomplice liability type of argument. It was merely stating the facts. It might have been inartfully in that I'm misleading you to believe that I was referring to accomplice liability. I wasn't. I was just referring to the facts which would support the verdict.
Mr. Tsushima, assuming that the accomplice instruction wasn't necessary, could I ask you to address this idea that the court seemed to have, the circuit court, that the only nexus under Rebeliza, the only nexus was motive, and that there wasn't anything else connecting this particular Miller, I guess, connecting Miller to these facts? And I'm curious about that analysis when he was with her in the apartment the evening she was stabbed, and clearly there was testimony that there was a male there that, and although it was disputed whether it was Caucasian, there's some evidence he was Caucasian.
That seemed to be a loss.
And it would seem that it was absolutely clear that Miller was the boyfriend, right? So why wouldn't there be something more than just motive, actually some facts that connect Miller to this case?
I mean, I don't want to repeat anybody or beat a dead horse, but I think Justice Nakayama had already addressed that in saying that it's a connection to the charged offense. So it's a connection to...
Well, I was actually going down that road. There, right. The offense takes place the same evening. Why wouldn't that be...
Well, the cases that talk to the facts that make it sufficient to draw the link talk about the third party actually being there, identification of the third party being there, not someone like him.
I see. So you're saying that the connection would actually have to be not that he was with her that evening, but he would actually, Miller would actually have to be placed at the scene.
Correct.
That's what you're saying.
Correct. And that's what the circuit court addressed, because the circuit, sorry. No, I cut you off.
I'm finished. Chief Justice.
What do you make of the fact that the witness who was near the scene found the cell phone, flipped it open, looked for history of calls, saw the name David, appeared many times, and Dan answered, told him that she found the phone, he knew who it belonged to, would be there to pick it up soon, and then Kato showed up. Does that tend to establish some involvement? First of all, that David is a reasonable inference that David is Miller, and secondly, the fact that
no, Chief Justice, respectfully, it's no different than the evidence that Justice Wilson had brought up of having had a drink with her earlier in the evening. It doesn't put him on the scene. It doesn't show he was involved in the commission of the offense itself.
I have a question regarding, I want to go back to the included issue, right?
Sure.
The instruction on reckless endangering. And the instruction talks about, you know, included offense, then you must consider whether the included offense of reckless endangering the second degree. So I'm wondering which subsection of 701.109, subsection 4, makes this an included offense of the original charge?
Sorry, I did not anticipate that question, Justice McKenna. I'm only aware of the case law, plethora of case law, that does indicate that reckless endangering in the second degree is indeed a lesser included offense of attempted murder.
Proof of same or less than all the facts required. That's subsection A, B is attempt to commit the offense charged. C differs from the offense charged only with respect to there's a less serious
state of mind.
Risk of injury or a different state of mind.
That's the one. That would be the one.
State of mind.
A lesser state of mind.
Oh.
Reckless being the state of mind. Reckless as to the intended or the conduct that, or sorry, not the conduct, the resulting injury.
But that's based on the theory that she is the, she was the perpetrator.
Correct.
Okay, so could you come back to my question? Call,
oh, sorry.
Call history of someone named David, makes the call, man answers in English, short time later, Kato shows up at the scene. That doesn't at least support an inference that the David was Mr. Miller and that Mr. Miller was in some way working in concert with Ms. Kato.
No, and again, respectfully, CJ, the same that we would submit, it does not connect that the drinking earlier in the night does not draw a connection of Mr. Miller in the commission of the crime.
That's different, but now you have him first showing up at the crime scene shortly after a call. I mean, I'm trying to understand, is it because you don't think the evidence supports the notion that David reasonably might have been expected to be Miller, or you don't think it matters?
Oh.
Ms. Morey calls David, assuming it was Miller, and suddenly Kato shows up suggesting you think it just might be legitimately, he thought that she was missing her cell phone and somehow he got in touch with her even though her phone was in the officer's hand at that time. I'm trying to.
I would say not the former, not that it wasn't David, not that it wasn't Miller, but that it doesn't show anything other than that there are some communications between them. That's not a link to the commission of the crime, the actual perpetration of the crime.
You seem to want us to ignore all the other evidence, right? That
no, not at all.
That, you know, Ms. Kato, that the CW, that Mr. Miller was with Ms. Kato before he started dating the CW, lived with the CW. When the CW left Mr. Miller, she stayed with Ms. Kato for a couple days, right?
Right.
No, and I don't want you now, to that on the date of the incident, Mr. Miller and Ms. Kato are back together, and with all the evidence that's been mentioned here, there's no evidence of a potential motive, is the state's position.
No.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying that. It doesn't draw the link.
You're saying that there's not enough evidence of a link to allow evidence of motive, but I thought you were also going to address the fact that, well, would you concede that a jury could find that Mr. Miller was there that night?
No.
Mr. Sushi,
there's no evidence showing that whatsoever. There wasn't a single.
You don't think that was on the jury's mind when they asked that question, that maybe it was Mr. Miller, since there was some evidence it was a Caucasian, although that was denied eventually, and that it was a male, and that it was somebody that had a knife? Do you remember?
On their mind,
and he testified that he carries a knife, right?
It'd be based off complete speculation and conjecture. Nobody placed him at the scene of that crime. Not one person.
Mr. Tsushima, I have to ask this question about your application and interpretation of Robaliza, but I keep responding, no evidence, absent of evidence.
Right, right.
Do you believe that Robaliza sets up as evidence standard somehow higher than 401 or 403? Is it some special evidentiary threshold, or is it just 401 and 403? What is it?
No, it doesn't set up well, how exactly do I word it? I think what Revoluza says is it acknowledges and addresses the 401 issue in laying out a legitimate tendency test.
So it requires, under your theory, it requires a certain category, a certain type of evidence. And my question then is, can we somehow trump the evidence code, 401 and 403? And the second half of that is, are we violating equal protection by setting up an evidentiary threshold that's higher for the defense to introduce certain types of evidence than it would be for the government?
No, absolutely
not. Aside from a violation of due process.
Absolutely not. And I don't want to repeat myself, but when Revoluza was written by Justice Nakayama, it acknowledged the 401, 402 implications. And actually, a defendant has brought up in another case, I wish I could recall it off the top of my head, the same concerns that you're presenting, Justice Pollack.
Can you submit the case after oral argument
if you
remember it then?
I could, and they rejected that argument.
So in other words, it's a 401 or 403 standard. It's relevancy.
Correct.
So what we should be applying is not looking at this connection or something like that, focusing. What we have to determine is, does under relevancy, whether or not the evidence has some tendency to pertain to a fact and issue in the case, and secondly, under 403, the standards in 403. That's what we should be applying. You agree?
Yes, of course, the rules of evidence absolutely should apply. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
But if that's the case, assuming that you decided to prosecute Mr. Miller, are you saying it would be irrelevant that there is a telephone call between him and Ms. Kato at the time that the incident was taking place, and it was irrelevant that there were people that identified a male Caucasian?
No, not at all.
That had a body type like his? Would that be irrelevant?
Was there any evidence that there was a telephone call between Kato and Miller at the time that it was taking place?
There's
no evidence.
It was a call log with the name David.
And also, the idea was that there are other witnesses who placed Kato at the scene. So
including
that's why,
herself.
Yeah, and her cell phone. And they said the perpetrator dropped the cell phone. And then the person from the gas station said she was there. Other people placed her at the scene. So it's not like she was there because Miller called her. And if someone picked up my phone and I dropped it somewhere and called my daughter, and my daughter would say, well, no, it's not. But I know whose phone it is, so I can get it to her or whatever. That doesn't mean I was there at the time she picked it up.
Absolutely. I don't mean to totally ignore what you're just addressing, but before I forget, it was an unpublished opinion that I found, but I have those citations for you. It's 355 Wisconsin 2nd, 579. It's State v. Rosenthal. It's a 2014
case. Does Wisconsin law allow citation to unpublished opinions? We have to go by Wisconsin law as to whether or not they allow unpublished citations to be considered persuasive.
Right. If this court finds it shouldn't be looking at it. I just wanted to address Justice Pollack's
What's the name of the case?
State v. Rosenthal, R-O-S-E-N-T-H-A-L. If this court finds it's not applicable or shouldn't be, absolutely. Okay.
All right.
I'm not saying this court should.
Mr. Tsushima, I need your help. So I heard you conceding that there was potential relevance, there was potential evidence that Mr. Miller may have had a motive.
Yes.
But so do you agree that the judge did preclude the defense from arguing that?
Yes. So, all right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just coming back to Justice Pollack's question, can realizing that ultimately it's a question is 401, 403, can this court identify principles that apply in particular situations to how the trial courts are analyzing these situations?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. The inquiry is 401-403 in this case. Is it your view that the court can, this court or another appellate court, provide guidance about how trial courts should analyze particular situations in terms of the principles they should look at and the factors they should apply?
Yes, absolutely, and I believe that's exactly what Revelisa was saying and was doing.
It sounds to me it's almost like a but-for test, so that the way trial courts may be interpreting Revelisa, and is that problematic?
I don't understand the but-for part.
I didn't hear the court apply. Maybe I don't think I went back and looked at it, but it seemed to me the court was very much focused on Revelisa and not 401 and 403, which by their very definition, especially 403, includes many, many factors. And as I indicated earlier, Addie Bowman describes Revelisa as better understood as 403. It's 403 balance, which the court's supposed to do, and that's not what happened here, it looks like to me.
Well, again, it used the legitimate test under Revelisa in aiding and making its decision, but there's nothing to say that the court ignored it. In fact, the court did address relevancy and did refer to 401, 402. Didn't say the words.
And the court found this evidence irrelevant? Is that the finding that we have to review? It's irrelevant?
What is that?
So well, it's irrelevant. That's the determination.
It fails to meet the relevancy, yes.
Okay. So we have to decide whether the evidence was relevant. And, of course, you know the definition of relevancy.
Right.
Anything
to
say about the Fifth Amendment issue or any other issues you wanted to address, Justice?
I'll only address the courts in the interest you guys have.
Okay, well, anything further at this time?
Nothing further for me.
I don't have anything specific. If any of the justices have any questions, direct questions about the record in this case, it was a very complicated case. Factually, it was a very frustrating case based upon how the evidentiary rulings went. And also want to point out that the 104 hearings, the timing of the 104 hearings, when it was conducted, again, it was like the fourth day of trial, after opening, after 11 witnesses. And when we called Mr. Miller to the stand, and then he started asserting his Fifth Amendment rights even more.
That didn't occur in front of the jury, right?
He basically just kind of signaled to have a recess taken.
I see.
And then over the defense objection, the trial court allowed a second 104 hearing. And the court did indicate, and this is on December the 17th, trial court indicated, it rendered because you were giving him new advice, and now it rendered the 104 yesterday almost useless. And now what we do it again, and it is upset, I would agree, it's probably changed at least some of what the lawyers had thought about last night. The bottom line is the decisions that were made in this particular case, or the rulings, the erroneous rulings we would submit, resulted in Mr. Miller essentially not answering any questions. And because of that, my client decided not to testify. So that altered the court, because what he would have said to her in the events leading up to and following the incident Without him testifying, I couldn't impeach him. I couldn't lay foundation for a prior inconsistent statement. And therefore, I would not have allowed that to get in because the government would have stood up to say, that's hearsay. That's hearsay. That's hearsay. I'm just kidding, hearsay. So because of the way the timing of the rulings on the 104 hearings, all of the Ms. Kato's decision to testify changed. And that ultimately changed.
But you would have had your client testify if she could have testified as to motive.
David Miller's motive? We would have talked to...
She would have testified if she could have on that issue.
Correct.
Wait a second. The court didn't preclude her from testifying?
No, the court
didn't.
The court did not preclude her from testifying. Correct. It was a decision. It was a tactical decision made because of the rulings at the two 104 hearings, particularly the second, in which basically the questions I was going to ask Mr. Miller was narrowed down significantly because the trial court ruled, and basically it was across the board, I'll allow him to take the fifth, I'll allow him to take the fifth. And the single time that she said that he did not have a right to take the fifth, in other words, compelling him to testify, what the single question was whether or not he gave a statement to the police, and that was it. Anything other than that, basically, the fifth was allowed to be asserted. So, I mean, the bottom line is our position is that Ms. Kato's, you know, right to testify was also in due process and right to fair trial were compromised because they were erroneous rulings. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you. Both of our attorneys and court will take this matter.
Eku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo kie kie hanohano okamoku aina ohoe. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.